Good morning.
Good morning.
So winter's not quite all gone yet. Seems like a pretty chilly week, but this is getting to be the end of February, so it can't go too much longer. So just think about sunshine.
Just ask your dad. He's seen snow in April.
Well, I have too, but I'm not proud of it.
Groundhog said?
I don't know what the groundhog said.
Six more.
Okay.
When he said it or not? From now.
Oh, I think when he
said it. When he said it.
He said it.
A couple of them, maybe.
Yeah.
And Laura, just don't remember. He doesn't really say anything.
Very special groundhog.
Okay. Well, we got caught up on the weather here, and so we can move along. We're in Luke chapter 16 today, and Luke chapter 16 is just full of surprises and challenges. So last week we read the parable about the unjust steward and the type of wisdom that he exhibited that human agility, which in spite of being on the wrong side of things, he was able to make his prospects better in the future. And I really think that if we consider that case carefully, we have to say, well, yep, that's probably the best you can hope for in this world. Best you can hope that money would provide you would be to buy friends. That's about all money's good for, ultimately. And so that then is a kind of judgment that Christ passed on its real value. He goes on then to speak of faithfulness. Verse 10, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. This addresses a point of perspective that I think that Christians should absolutely incorporate into their thinking. It's easy as human beings to feel like, well, this particular situation in life or this part of my life is no big deal. I don't have to be concerned about it. Just let it fly. Or, it kind of hits me sometimes whenever I'm walking across the yard, maybe going into a place of one of my locations where I pay taxes, and there's junk on the ground. Somebody's thrown something out. I didn't put it there, and it'll probably blow away. But just that concern about the care of things that says, well, why don't you just pick it up? If you pick it up and throw it away, then somebody else doesn't have to worry about it. It's not a big deal. It's not a big issue. But it's concerned with the details of life, the realization that sometimes the small things make a big difference. And if you will attend to the small things, you're going to be more prepared to address the big issues of life. It's so easy to check out in some area of life because either it doesn't pertain to you or it doesn't concern you. And Jesus says, he that is faithful in the least is faithful also in much. And I want to be accounted by him as faithful.
It's easy to think that as long as I get the big things right, then I'll be okay. But it's actually, if you do the little things, then the big things will fall into place.
It helped me to be told one time that, what if everybody did what I'm doing right now? You know, if I choose to pick up that piece, if everybody did those little things,
right,
the world would be a lot better place. And so do what you want everybody to do. Just be faithful yourself.
Yes. Yes. But that, you know, that that picture of faithfulness is so vital, right? Faithful in the things that maybe somebody else doesn't give you praise for, and you're not looking for praise for, but just the realization that even when nobody's watching, I'm going to be faithful. So, which of course is a very stark contrast to the steward in the last parable who was unfaithful in the management of his Lord's goods in a big way. He continues in verse 12, and if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And again, that is a term which just means riches. Who is your master? Who are you serving? And the backdrop, of course, of this whole chapter is the audience, that part of the audience, which is dominated by the mindset of the Pharisees. Luke tells us here that the Pharisees also, who were covetous, and the Greek word there means literally loving money. They loved money. They were a friend of money. They heard these things, and they derided him, or they turned their nose up at him. They scoffed at him. So Jesus is confronting this strong worldview that is influencing all those who he is speaking to. You know, we are affected by the predominant mindset of those around us. What people around us think tends to affect us. We tend to respond to it. And if there are no voices to counter those influences, we'll probably be swept in that direction. I mean, sometimes you have to be the voice yourself that speaks to your own mind and says, no, we're not going that way. I'm not going to think that way. And so Jesus was compelled here. He was on a mission to change how people thought, because that changes their life. And so he is directly combating this mindset of loving wealth and what it brings. And so Luke points out here that he had opposition with regard to the Pharisees and how they thought, and that's why some of these things were said. Next, he says a very strong statement, which we sometimes comment that, you know, some verses don't work that well on your kitchen wall. This one, I think, does. He says, ye are they which justify themselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. Now, there's a very strong expression of a change of mindset. That which by nature men esteem, that which by nature men hold highly, is abomination in the sight of God. So the language there is reflected in the translation. So to esteem highly comes from the concept of being high, of being lofty, of being exalted. And by contrast, before God, it is a detestable thing, a foul thing. And anything that we consider to be foul, we get certainly out of our sight and out of our smell and out of our presence. We want to get rid of it. Don't want it to have any place in our life. So we must ask ourselves as we pursue the path of following Jesus, what are the things that God despises? one of the things that men esteem so highly, that they value so highly, but in fact God despises. And in this chapter in particular, Jesus is focusing on wealth and money. Verse 17, and it is easier for heaven and earth to pass than one jot. I'm sorry, I'm remembering Matthew. Than one tittle of the law to fail. And so this expression, one tittle, refers to the very small markings on letters that distinguish them sometimes from one another. In English, you might think of the difference in a capital O and a capital Q. The only difference is that little bitty tail down at the bottom, right? And yet, the difference in letter makes a huge difference in meaning. I don't have any words right off. Q words are not that common, but in Hebrew, I understand that there are some slight differences in letters that make a huge difference in meaning. And so Jesus is reflecting on the fact that among the rabbis, there was an established hierarchy of laws. So there are the greatest laws and there are the least laws. And so some things are of lesser consequence in their minds. And his criticism of their worldview, his criticism of the way they think, says, no, it's easier for heaven and earth to pass than the slightest detail of God's will to pass. And so another point of perspective where you don't relativize what God wants of you as being less important and therefore maybe not even essential, and at the same time claim to be the ones who uphold his law to the highest, because the Pharisees presented themselves as being the ones who had a deeper understanding, who had a more careful analysis of what was lawful. And yet in the process, they ended up negating important aspects of what God wanted from man, and were simultaneously criticizing Jesus for violating some minute aspect of their tradition, while simultaneously avoiding the weight of God's law. Then we make what seems to be a bit of a jump here. The very next verse says, "Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery." And you might wonder first how we got here. We were talking about money and wealth, and now we're talking about divorce. Well, this all actually makes a lot of sense in light of the conceptual context that Jesus is speaking into. One of the aspects of the rabbinic approach that Jesus seemed to particularly dislike was what they had done to marriage. We know from various ancient texts that the rabbis had debated long and hard about when it was lawful to divorce. Now, interestingly, the law says very little about divorce. And so Jesus is not quoting a law here whenever he makes this proclamation. The law does condemn adultery. And there's actually only one passage in the law of Moses which basically describes the process of divorce and doesn't make a proclamation about it otherwise. Jesus reflects on that in Matthew and says, well, Moses allowed you to do that, but from the beginning, that was not God's will. That's not what God had planned. That's not what God had instituted. But nevertheless, the rabbis had taught that at this time, the popular position was that a man might divorce his wife for any reason. If she burned his dinner, if she oversalted his soup, if he saw somebody else he liked better, he could divorce his wife. So that's the world that Jesus is speaking to. And so while they are back here criticizing him and trying to destroy his influence, he hits on two key issues where they are very vulnerable. Number one, they love money. And he totally upends that worldview by suggesting, first of all, you know, the best money can do for you is buy you friends. If you, as the unjust steward, will financially relieve people's load, that will get you friends, at least for a while. That's what it's good for. But nothing else. And he's going to enter into a parable coming up the very next verse, which even enforces that more. But so that's one area where the Pharisees are particularly vulnerable. But another way is where they had come down on the whole relationship of marriage and had departed from God's original plan of it being an institution whereby two human beings entered into a lifelong covenant, which resulted in the betterment of both, and had instead reduced it to a ceremony of convenience and lust, which was not God's intent at all. So they were very vulnerable here, and by their interpretation of the law, they had rendered one of the commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery, essentially lame, by creating a means to propagate adultery through the process of their divorce and remarriage. Now, Jesus is not speaking directly into the complexities of relationship that exists in all of time and all of human experience. It's tempting to take verses like this and try to answer all the questions that might exist. And you can't do that. You really can't. I've encountered people who, in their desire for a simple answer to difficult questions, have done that, and they end up propagating a point of view which results in absolutely impossible positions. For instance, if you were to follow their line of thinking, the best advice you could give to a young person would be, you know, if you're going to be wild, go out and be wild. Just don't get married. Right? Because according to their prescription, it doesn't matter what you do, as long as you don't marry somebody, you can still go on and get married sometime. Right? Do you really think that's the position Jesus wants to project? No, it's not. It's quite understandable here what he is doing. This is a position in support of marriage. It's a position in support of certainly the more vulnerable party to the marriage in this world, a world where men dominated these relationships. Among Jews, it wasn't common for a woman to be able to divorce her husband. The Romans and Greeks, particularly the Romans, allowed that during this period. And there were Hellenized Jews that did as well, but in general, that was not an option for the wife. An interesting backdrop to this, of course, is the whole situation with Herod Antipas and John the Baptist, where Herod he was married to a lot of marriages back then were for political reasons, at least started with. And so he had married an Arabian king's daughter in hopes of having better political interaction to the east. Well, that didn't work out. And she realized he wasn't faithful, and she managed to escape and was no longer his wife. And so then he married his brother slash stepbrother slash half-brother. Herod's King Herod's family was kind of complicated, his family tree. And so she was also his niece. But anyway, it was his brother's wife, and that was specifically prohibited in the law. And so John the Baptist condemned him for it and ended up losing his head over it. But I forgot where I was going when I headed this direction. It was a messy world with regard to marriage and divorce. And all of Jesus' comments on the subject can be seen as a defense of marriage. His bottom line is, from the beginning, it was not so. That's not God's intention. And so, here, he points out that their position, their considered theological position on this, resulted in the essence of adultery. The real heart of adultery is about betrayal, betrayal of trust, betrayal of relationship, betrayal of commitment. And with their cavalier attitude toward the relationship in general, that's what Jesus equated it with. And so this is another blow in this interaction with the Pharisees that is a part of this chapter. Now, I have moved right along through these verses. If there's anything you would like to comment on or have a question on that I might be able to answer, help yourself. But I understand this in the context of his interaction with the Pharisees. So that brings us to verse 19 and another famous parable that Jesus tells us. He says, "There was a certain rich man which was clothed in purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day." Now, the rich man doesn't get a name here. He's sometimes referred to as the... there's a Latin word, and I don't know if it is pronounced with two syllables or one. D-I-V-E-S is his name. Would it be Dives? Dives? Okay, typically. And so sometimes you hear about Lazarus and Dives. Well, that's just a way of referring to the story. Jesus doesn't give him a name. And the Dives refers to the Latin for rich man. So he was clothed in purple and fine linen. The word for fine linen here refers to an Egyptian linen, which is said to be worth twice its weight in gold. It is so valued. And of course, the purple is cloth that was dyed in the famous Phoenician dye, which only royalty and the very wealthy were allowed to have. It's extremely expensive. It comes from a shellfish. It takes thousands of these mollusks to produce the dye for even one garment. And it's a very tedious, expensive, and smelly process that involves a fermentation. But it produces a dye which is incredibly color fast. Reports from the ancient world claim that it doesn't fade in the sun. It actually grows more brilliant and can last hundreds of years. So it was very highly valued. And so Jesus paints a picture here of a man who has the nicest of the nice. He fared sumptuously every day. Don't know how he made his money, but he spent it on himself, clearly. And there was a certain beggar who has a name, named Lazarus, that was laid at his gate, full of sores. And desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, the dogs came and licked his sores, which I know it sounds maybe a little gross, but actually there can be some medicinal value in that kind of treatment, I understand, at least if you're a dog. I don't know if it works that way for people or not, but you know that the young are often treated by their mothers by licking. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom, which is just a way of saying to Abraham's protection. The rich man also died and was buried. And in hell he lifted up his eyes, being in torments, and seeth Abraham afar off and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus, that he may dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am tormented in this flame. But Abraham said, Son, remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus' evil things. But now he is comforted, and thou art tormented. And beside all this, betwixt us and you, there is a great gulf fixed, so that they which would pass from hence to you cannot, neither can they pass to us that would come from thence. Then he said, I pray thee therefore, Father, that thou wouldest send him to my father's house, for I have five brethren, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come into this place of torment. Abraham saith unto him, They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he said, Nay, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. And he said unto him, If they will not If they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. And so, there you have a powerful picture, don't you, that Jesus creates. He doesn't, at the end, say, and the moral of this story is, it just stops, right? And we are left wondering, how many of these details should we apply to the other world, and what should we learn from this? Well, first of all, I'll ask you this. You guys are really quiet this morning. What was the problem with the rich man? Does Jesus give us any indication of why he is in torment after he dies? How bad a guy was he?
Well, it's not, the problem wasn't that he was rich, but there seems to be some kind of connection to he was turned in on himself. Mm-hmm. So he had plenty, but he didn't notice anybody but himself.
Yes, it seems to be very definitely a dramatic picture of somebody that is totally focused on their own comfort. Let's face it, purple may be pretty, but you don't have to have it. You don't have to have it to be comfortable and warm. It's over the top. It's looking for something that is a luxury item in the ultimate. You know, why do you do that? Why would you want that? We hear of examples, you know, in our world, whether it be golden toilets or some other exotic thing that people put their money in. Those things aren't even functional in any serious way. They don't just supply a need, they are over the top. And so, number one, it's a picture of somebody that's totally consumed with whatever their own desires might be. And he is totally oblivious to the needs of others around him. So you had somebody who was laying at the gate of his house, who was seriously in need. And not just seriously in need, but who was looking for real solutions. You know, one thing that we encounter in our world, there are, you know, it has become almost a vocation for some people to be in need. That's their living. They're in need. They stay in need, and they present themselves of, I need. They're not looking to change their situation. They're not looking to get out of it. They're not looking to get better. They're happy to hold their sign or whatever, and to stay just exactly in that state. Doesn't seem to be the case with Lazarus. He was sick. He was without sustenance. And he was desiring to be fed with crumbs. And the rich man was totally oblivious to it.
The crumbs aren't exactly a luxury.
No. And of course, that's kind of a euphemistic word for the garbage, right? Just what's left over. But I think what's interesting here is that the Jesus doesn't set this up as this was a, here's what he did, right? He did this, this, and this, and therefore he's suffering this. He gives us a picture of what a lot of people think is a legitimate end. I'm going to spoil myself, right? I'm going to live a life, a for me life. If I don't live for me, who will? Have you ever seen that line or something like it? Certainly the Pharisees would have been in that category. Their love of money, their manipulation of the law in their own interests.
Well, even back to the, you know, pick your wife out and get another one. You want everything that you want, and you want it now, and this is how you, and never mind the fact that you're forcing someone else to be turned into a beggar or worse.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And yet, you know, the rich man probably didn't think of himself as a sinner. You know, he's not perhaps directly breaking the law, but he is totally, pardon me?
He's not following Jesus in this example.
Right. And of course, the general understanding of sin as fundamentally a total separation from all that God is, all of his goodness, all that he wants, all of his way. It's about being lost from the goodness of God and pursuing things which are just of nature or happen to come up on your radar as desirable at the moment. It's not a life that's guided by the principles of God's goodness. So it's interesting, I say, to notice that he's not portrayed as an evil person in the ways that you might expect.
It just seems that he might have neglected to do good when he could have been a help to Lazarus. We're not really told much, but it doesn't say that he fed him or had any positive effect on his life.
Yeah, so the only thing that that neglect, I think, doesn't catch is the fact that he was... You know, neglect suggests just a letting things happen, right? A lack of action. But notice the action of his life. He was clothed in purple. He lived lavishly.
Yeah,
he wasn't a man that didn't act in his world. He was very active, but only for his own satisfaction.
Keith?
Yes.
It's so interesting that it seems like the condemnation for his actions or lack of actions towards others is towards the person who's sitting at his own gate. Christ isn't condemning him for, you know, not sending aid over to this place over here or those people over there that he may or may not have any knowledge of or any personal connection to. There was a beggar at your gate. You knew about it, and he was within your circle. You know, quite literally, you're nearly bumping into him every day, and you still didn't care.
Yes, there was need right there. But then again, I do say, don't forget, you did have motivation. You were active. It's not just, oh, you slipped up. All your energy was focused on yourself. And if that's the case, you are going to forget those far or near that are need, that you have the ability to help, you know.
He didn't just see the purple robe at the local market and, oh, I need a new robe, I'll take the purple one.
Right. You didn't come by these easy, and you know, in some periods of time it was even illegal to have them if you weren't in a certain status. So they were exceptional. Don't forget how exceptional this picture starts in this description of him. This purple and fine linen and fared sumptuously every day is a picture of incredible decadence.
Something that stands out to me is just how well he knew Lazarus, because he specifically in hell asked for Lazarus.
Yeah, that's a good point. He couldn't say, "Well, I didn't know about him," because he points him out. Whereas before he shunned him, apparently now he's willing to take a drop of water from his finger. That guy with sores, you know. His values have changed considerably. So it seems that in this chapter, this parable Jesus tells acts as kind of a capstone to his comments on the Pharisees and their pursuit of wealth. He appreciates its importance, and I think the parable of the unjust steward. But then, by drawing this picture, wow, what a sobering thought that, you know, all the things that are most important to me, all the things that I am trying to acquire and incorporate into my life, in fact, might get me where? In eternity? Not where I want to be. So Jesus doesn't give us much insight into the world to come in throughout the Gospels. We have little snippets, you know. He tells his disciples, "In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you." We have this parable. And
mansions, that's not the word that we think of, correct?
Right.
Just dwelling places?
Yes.
Okay.
I was just quoting the King James.
Right, sure. And even if, you know, if we form our picture from this very small bit of information,
yeah,
it's not the way it's...
But, you know, you add to that the streets are of gold, so what do you think the houses are going to be like? Right. We'll be happy with them. I'm sure of that. It's interesting, too, Abraham's response to his desire to persuade his brothers not to come here. He says, well, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And you might ask yourself, well, how do Moses and the prophets inform our understanding of the wrongness of this rich man's choices and his lifestyle? So I ask you that.
How to be right with God and how to be right with your neighbor.
Okay, but commandment-wise, do you have anything?
Yeah, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself.
And your neighbor as yourself. Okay, so there is this consciousness of those around you that is created by the law. And in particular, if you read the prophets in detail, you'll find that there is a deep passion for the needs of the side of society that's in need, the widows, the orphans, those that are poor. That absolutely is a focus in the prophets. And we find that this gentleman absolutely ignores all of that. He lives a life that is totally about making himself comfy and pampered to the max. And it seems that the message we should take from this, you know, it's not just about did you commit a specific sin and therefore you're going to pay for it. It's about this is a way of thinking. This is about a way of life. This is about the direction you're going in all that you do. And if you're going this way, you're not going to spend eternity with God. You're just not. And so once we get beyond that point of saying, well, am I good enough? Or have I done anything wrong? And start thinking about, what does he want of me? How does he want me to shape my life and my mind? We're on a totally different road. We're on the road of following Jesus. And we're not looking to be justified in the details of this, that, and the other. We want to do what's right. We don't want to be in the wrong. But there's this overarching passion of finding the heart of God and the mind of God and implementing it in our lives on a daily basis. So, Lord, don't show me just what I have to do to get by. Show me what you want me to do. I want to be a profitable servant in your sight.
And let your thinking shape my thinking.
Absolutely.
So it's when Jesus tells a story, it causes the hearers to, wait a minute, if everything I have doesn't keep me from dying, then how should I live, whether I'm wealthy or poor? It should change the way you live.
Let this mind be in you, right? Which was also in Christ Jesus. So just as kind of an aside here, sometimes conversational Christianity, people advance arguments like once a child, always a child, right? So in other words, if you've ever been saved in some sense, you'll never otherwise, you don't have any other option. That's what's going to happen. Notice here the language between the rich man and Abraham. The rich man calls Abraham father. Abraham responds to him as son. And yet clearly the relationship that exists here is not the one you're looking for in the end. Now, the word for son here, it's interesting to me. So when we talk about son of God in Scripture, it's huios is the Greek word. This is a technon, which means more generally child or offspring, but it can mean son too. And so it's fun to look at the translations of this, realizing that translators may be influenced by this argument. So ESV translates child. Child, remember that you in your lifetime received good things. King James does son. Complete Jewish Bible does son. NAS says child. And NIV says son. So interesting variety there in how the translators feel compelled to translate that word. But in all cases, the rich man calls Abraham father. Pater. So there clearly is not a consistency of language here that would indicate that the Bible thinks about this father-son situation as is sometimes imposed on it by popular theology. The fact is, we all are in some sense the son of God, the sons of God, and that we are created in His image. But we are very definitely falling from that status, and would have to look elsewhere for our parentage in terms of our conduct and what it resembles until He changes us. So anyway, that's a more nuanced situation than sometimes is attributed to it. I hope it's not true that once you're a son, always a son in a spiritual sense, because at one time I was definitely, on the basis of my conduct, a child of the devil, and I don't want to stay there. So,
I'm just thinking about how, so it's the legalistic mind would say, okay, well, I'll never want, the most expensive in our society, the most expensive car, or the most expensive whatever, and so then I'm okay. But I think in essence, if I understand correctly, that gentleman was responding to a certain group of people that he would have belonged to because of his wealth, trying to make himself, his mind was obsessed with keeping in that status. And probably any status that we're in, if that is the mindset we're in, to make sure we're accepted by our, whatever the normal comforts of my level, my status, if I am possessed by reaching that rather than, Lord, what is your will for me to do with whatever money I have, and that I could, any level almost could be in the same mindset. Just, it's not just like the highest level of income is where the problem is. It's where, like you said, what is guiding our thinking.
Right, and of course, too, I have certain resources. Resources can be used in different ways. Do I have any concern about the needs of others?
Yeah.
Or am I totally looking to put my resources into my own comforts?
And that keeps us constantly with every decision before Him.
Because, in fact, the things that men so highly value, God doesn't. And in eternity, it's what He values that's going to actually be of value to everybody. Thank you.